Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve and I discuss the through lines over the last several interviews. And those interviews include Sean Campbell, Ganesh Krishnan, and Ellie Pavlik. What have we learned from those conversations? And what questions do they raise? So Steve, first this season, we spoke with Sean Campbell, and he's the founder and CEO of Cascade Insights. Sean has been working remotely for over a decade, and he had some really good advice for our listeners about working from home and about hybrid models. So talk to us about what he discussed with us about the total return to office. What did he have to say about the risks and the potential in that model?
Well, I think what was interesting about Sean, which is actually why we wanted him on the podcast, was that for a lot of people, you know, we seem to have imagined that this sort of hybrid working, and so therefore the issue about whether or not you return to the office or what have you, was new. And it was something that was coming off the back of the pandemic. And the reality, of course, is that it is nothing new. For a lot of organizations, it did force them into a position that perhaps they wouldn't have naturally chosen. But both in his case and also, you know, here at the ISF, we've had a hybrid working models, gosh, for, I don't know, the best part of 15 years. Brought about, of course, because we've got a dispersed workforce all around the world. So I thought it was interesting to just, you know, revisit, if you like, the fact that what we're dealing with is not something that's completely earth-shatteringly new for a lot of people, and to provide that context. That being said, clearly, in a post-pandemic world, trying to return to something that equates to a sort of a normal business pattern for a lot of organizations when it comes to their people and physically being present in an office has proved problematic. And it was interesting to just hear him talk about the way in which, you know, hybrid or remote has a lot of benefits. But I think for me, the piece that perhaps we didn't get into as much as I might have liked was that actually, you know, these are people-related business decisions that are having to be made. And again, it goes back to some of the themes that you and I talked about over the years, which is about transparency. And I think that, you know, the real essence of whether or not you can make this a success, whether it be remote working, hybrid working, in-office working, whatever it is, the key to success is being very open and transparent with people. So if you have a solid business need to have people in the office, then you need to tell them why. You need to explain that. And it's perfectly fine if some of your people decide that you're no longer the company for them because they want to work 100% remote. Where I have a problem is where we're somehow sort of pretending and creating, you know, well, there's a security issue or there's this issue or that issue, to get over the fact that perhaps we're not as good as we ought to be at communicating with our people. And that, I think, is the real essence of the challenge. And so in some of the things that we then went on to talk about, he did talk about ways of managing people remotely or more transparently or better. You know, you can pick any of those different adjectives based on what you take away from the discussion that we had. But for me, I think for anybody listening to this or indeed to that particular podcast with him, you know, the essence of it is you need to figure out what is in the best interests of the business, your shareholders, what you're trying to do, and convey that very clearly to employees so that everybody can make the right decision as to what's best for them. And then you stay true to it. So, you know, it's no good changing it around. You have to be completely true to the position that you've taken and be prepared, I think, to continually modify that as is necessary. So those are some of the interesting things that I think it made me think about having spoken to Sean.
Do you think it's good enough for a business leader to say, I want you to return to the office because I want you to return to the office?
I personally, no. I think that there has to be a reason. you know, and in that instance, there probably is a reason. It could be a very personal reason. It could be that, you know, it's a family-run business, for instance, mm-hmm. and that's the way it's always been done. Or it could be that somebody has a particular perspective on the why. But I think that business leaders have to be prepared to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And I think that's healthy. Mm-hmm. And I think actually thinking through why you want to do something is the right way to go. So again, if you look at the ISF, then I believe that when our teams get together to collaborate, we produce something that is particularly special and very rich from an intellectual, from a business standpoint. That's one of the reasons why I would like them to get together on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. It isn't necessary, however, for them to be in the office every single day of the week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been very clear about that, that I do not want people to be spending hours in a day traveling to and from work to do what they could do equally well by staying at home or in a local meetup mm-hmm. location. So it is almost a case, and I know other business leaders who said this and agree with me, where if you come into the office, it's almost a case of leaving your computer at home mm-hmm. because you're going into the office to collaborate, mm-hmm. to communicate, to do something that you can't do in isolation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, people listening to this will think, well, you know, I run a call center. You know, how could I possibly do that? Or, you know, I run some other line of business. And this is why it's very important to look at it from the perspective of what are you trying to do and what does your business actually need? And then you can articulate those messages very clearly, I think, to the people that you have working with you. And you need to be prepared for them to make up their own minds as to whether or not that way of working is right for them. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong for you mm-hmm. either, you know? And I think that's the difference. It may well be that you have to agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a healthy discussion to be had.
I like that you're encouraging business leaders to investigate, because I do think that probably some business leaders think I want it because I want it, but you're saying go deeper. There is a reason, even if it is an emotional reason, a non-quantifiable reason. And I think that that's important, because culture is hard to discuss sometimes. It's a little bit more ephemeral than, well, we have, you know, 3,000 square feet that we're paying for, so we need to, you know, that's quantifiable data. But yeah. That family business idea, or this is the way it's always been done, and so part of it is just based on history, I think that's a good reminder to people to self-assess.
Yeah, I think it is. And personally, I would much rather be having those conversations openly rather than somehow to stumble on the fact that conversations like that were taking place in closed chat groups. Mm-hmm. Because at least if you're having the open conversation, you're in a position to gather all the facts, mm-hmm. determine the best way forward, and communicate. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to do that if you're not getting the full picture.
Yeah. I also really liked what Sean had to say about meetings. Don't mistake having a meeting for getting work done. What was your takeaway from that part of your conversation? Was there something that has remained with you?
Yeah, I think that he made some very good points there, didn't he, about, you know, not sort of just staying on because it was scheduled to be 3/4 hour. So, you know, even though you're done after 30 minutes, you've still got 50 minutes to sit there and what have you. And I think that a lot of the things he was talking about for remote are equally applicable in the in-person environment. And I think that, again, perhaps we've forgotten some of that in that sort of remote working piece. So I do think that there were some good takeaways in terms of being very precise about who you actually have in the meeting, mm-hmm. being respectful of people's time. So we all know that, particularly in remote working, you can pretty much guarantee the time that you want to set up your Teams link is the time that it won't work.
Yes.
Yeah, and we've all been there.
Yep.
So factor it in. We all know that occasionally we put our microphones on mute and, you know, then we spend the next, you know, 10 minutes telling somebody that they're actually on mute and we can't hear them and, you know, all of that kind of yeah. thing. So there's a hygiene, I think, that we can all get better at. And I think there were some good messages in that because it just saves everybody's time. And again, it's about being respectful for the environment that you're using, for the tool that you're using. And that really gets the meeting going much more effectively, much more efficiently. And the goal is to reach the conclusion you want to reach and shut it all down.
I think also don't be afraid to run short.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need to fill the airtime.
Yeah, you said if you're sitting there for after 30 minutes, and I thought, or three minutes, you know, that's fine too. Sean also made a nice point about encouraging employees to reach out and to ask, you know, quote, stupid questions if they're feeling stuck. And that can be a little bit trickier in a remote environment when there's this online component. What did you think of that point that he made?
Yeah, I thought that one really resonated, particularly when you look at new hires. You know, if you've got a company that is growing, where you're bringing new people in all the time, and you haven't got them physically, so they haven't had the benefit of being able to form some kind of relationship, and you're communicating with them remotely, it can be very tough for them to just, you know, ask those questions, because they're the outsider, if you like. So he made some very valid points, I think, about the role of the manager in all of that, in terms of, you know, helping people to understand that there wasn't a stupid question. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't understand, then do speak up, because there may well be other people in that call who also don't understand, mm-hmm. but are perhaps reluctant to say so. So I think that the big sort of takeaway, again, for me there was the role of the manager in it, you know, or the facilitator, or the person who's running the meeting. You know, do keep checking that people are still there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've all been in meetings where the screen is frozen or where the camera has suddenly gone off. And there is a different set of skills that you need to bring to make people feel comfortable, not feel stupid about the fact that their technology isn't working. Again, just to get the best from the meeting. And lots of people listening to this will think, well, yeah, we do that. But actually, you know, we don't, mostly, because we fall into bad habits. Mm. And we forget. And the worst ones, I think, for me, are what I would call the hybrid meetings, where perhaps you've got some people physically in the room, and then the other one's remote.
It's a misery.
And, you know, if you're chairing that meeting, you need to work exceptionally hard to make sure that you're getting the best from all of the people that are there. Because actually, if you don't do that, why did you bother to invite them?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there were some really interesting perspectives that he brought to that.
I agree. I thought that was a really engaging conversation. That led into an interview with Ganesh Krishnan, who has worked in cybersecurity for over 25 years for giants like Yahoo and LinkedIn. And more recently, he has founded his own company, Anzena, which has a mission to engage and equip all employees with simple and effective security tools. Oh, I know that we always like to talk to those really experienced CISOs. And, you know, with a skills shortage, I think that they're in increasingly short supply or hard to find sometimes. But I think that one thing that Ganesh, with his level of experience, highlighted was the need for CISOs to prioritize, especially as resources are more scarce. What did you think about that point he made about where to focus and where to put attention when resources are not flush?
Yeah, I think it's something that again, a lot of people will be able to relate to, because we've been talking for years about the fact that, you know, there is a skill shortage in the industry. And it is about, I think, how you prioritize. And I think that a lot of, it's not just CISOs, is it? It's every aspect of a business. You know, we all struggle to look at where we should be spending our time when we're very busy. But of course, when you take that into a security realm, then that has implications, and very serious implications if you happen to get it wrong. Mm. So that focus is absolutely essential. It needs to be in line with what the business is trying to achieve. So again, this alignment mm-hmm. between security and business needs. And I think as well, one of the things that it made me think about was, very often still, I think, CISOs or security leaders are almost reluctant to put their hand up and say, hold on, I don't have enough resources for this particular task. And I would like to see that happening very much more often, because you can't continue to get everything done that needs to be done if you don't have the right resources for it. Mm-hmm. And that's frankly is a business decision. And there may be good reasons for that. But I think for as long as you try and paper over the cracks, you're really compounding the problem. So I would encourage security leaders always to be very open and pragmatic with the business in terms of what is possible and what is not possible, and to seek you know, advice, guidance, support in terms of where that focus ought to be, mm-hmm. and indeed how things might be improved, and to openly discuss the implications of not doing something. You know, again, we're moving very much more to a risk-based environment mm-hmm. where we always need to be assessing the risk of doing something versus not doing something. And so I think it plays very well in that sort of scenario. And I think that business leaders in general understand that and would expect actually to hear those and have those sorts of conversations with their security leaders. Mm-hmm.
Ganesh also spoke a little bit about the importance of educating the entire business, empowering all stakeholders to behave securely. And that's something that you and I have discussed many, many times. He has an informed perspective because his company is directly trying to empower employees throughout the business to do that. Talk to us about what you took away from Ganesh's teaching style or his mission in empowering everybody throughout the enterprise. Was there anything new or different that he offered that made you think in a different way?
I think he highlights one of the most challenging issues for a lot of organizations, which is how do you get everybody involved in a security process? How do you demonstrate to them that there is value in what they have to do? Mm-hmm. You know, again, it comes back to a point I was making earlier with Sean. We probably don't spend enough time explaining. And what I've always found is that if you can explain why something has to be done, people, again, are much more receptive to it. And the same is so true in security. Because there are certain things that people may be required to do where it's not immediately obvious why that is the case. Mm-hmm. If you use a very simple instance, if you take multi-factor authentication, why is that important? Why do organizations have it? If you're particularly, say, in the sales side of the house or others, you may find it a complete irritation. Mm-hmm. It slows you down. Every time you want to access something, you've suddenly got to get your phone out. And so that can be an irritation. That can suddenly color the whole way in which you look at a security function. Mm-hmm. It's preventing me from accessing information. It's preventing me from doing my job effectively. But if you flip that to explain why it's necessary within that particular business context, because the information that's being accessed is important, it's critical to what's happening, we need to secure that information, you have a role to play in that, and actually it's in your interest because you don't want somebody accessing your account and changing it and so on, mm-hmm. then that's a pretty good way of positioning it. And I think we need to spend very much more time doing that.
Yeah, I think that that is very important to. Again, it sort of relates back to don't just tell your employees you want them in the office because you want them in the office. Don't just tell your stakeholders throughout the enterprise that they need to do these security measures because they need to do these security measures. They need to understand that they are an important part of the process and that they do have a key role to play. And I think that that relates to Ganesh's, the part of the discussion that you had with going back to this remote work, that whether you're going to bring everybody back into the office or you're going to have a hybrid model or everyone is remote, security policies need to be developed with those specific parameters in mind, and cyber hygiene has to be a part of that setup. Is that something that people are thinking enough about? I mean, do they ever think enough about cyber hygiene? But in these new models, are they thinking enough about that?
I think the issue of policies is one that lots of people sort of groan at. The reality is that security policies in general, always need to be refreshed. Mm-hmm. And you always need to take the opportunity then to look at the context within which you're then operating. You know, business is not static. If we look at it through the cyber lens, then increasingly we're seeing much more regulation, legislation, that sort of thing coming in. So a lot of the work that we do at the ISF on behalf of our members is just helping them with their policy work, keeping that up to date, keeping it refreshed. And I think that that in itself is a pretty good process, just to keep going back over some of those things and just checking to see whether or not they're still fit for purpose. And it isn't just about compliance. It is about making sure that what you've got in place, yes, of course, is compliant with legislation, but also is helping move the business forward. So if you can't, again, explain why you've got a policy there, you should really question why you have it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, again, is something that perhaps we don't do often enough. it's okay to retire policies that no longer have applicability.
Mm-hmm.
And the fewer you can have, the better shape you're in, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You do, obviously, depending on the industry that you're in, have to fall in line with some of the very, very stringent regulations, particularly I'm thinking if you're in the financial services space now, it's becoming very much more difficult, particularly if you operate across multiple jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
And you are seeing as well that a lot of your auditors, external auditors who are coming in to check on compliance issues, are very much more up to speed now with the environments. There was a time when perhaps, you know, you could gloss over things. But most externals now really do know what they're looking for and will ask you very specific questions and want you to demonstrate that you've got the right processes in place, one of which, of course, is always around business continuity and how you would deal with ransomware and so on. So again, from an ISF standpoint, you know, we spend a lot of time running those sorts of exercises, as I say, helping people to bring policies up to speed, up to date, and conducting reviews for them to make sure that what they're using is actually fit for purpose. And I think that's something that businesses always need to be mindful of.
Mm-hmm. Our next interview was with Dr. Ellie Pavlik, who focused on AI. But before we move away from Ganesh Krishnan, he touched on AI a little bit himself about whether or not we should be asking employees to worry about mundane tasks as much. He discussed a bit how AI is going to change how we work. And I'm wondering what your takeaway was with that, AI and its coming role in security.
Yeah, I mean, AI is, you know, you can't have a conversation today with pretty much anybody.
About anything. It's everywhere. Breakfast,
it
AI.
Is everywhere. And what I find interesting is that we started at the ISF talking about some of the challenges that AI would bring probably about 5-6 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And really trying to sort of lay out a path for the future in terms of how organizations should adapt their working patterns to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because to your point, I think it does have a lot of value that it can bring, particularly in the security space, but not just there. You know, I think anywhere where you have skill shortages, resource shortages, technology has a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's about technology working in isolation. I think it's about how the individual, how humans work with that technology. So for me, it is about the role that AI has to play in our future lives and us being very, very circumspect about what AI can do better than the human and what the human can do better than AI. And if we can reach a point where we've got the two of those working synergistically, then we will have cracked it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move to your conversation with Dr. Ellie Pavlik. She's a computer scientist at Brown University, and it was really interesting to get her academic perspective, especially as AI has been not just so prominently featured in the news, but constantly discussed in every aspect of every part of life for the last, I don't know, almost 6 months. It feels like January 1st, the conversation turned to AI all the time. So Ellie was actually pretty conservative in terms of wanting to wait and see. But in business, you know, we don't have the luxury of sitting back and waiting for 3 or 4 or 5 years to see what happens. So talk to me about what you took away from her perspective of where we are with AI development, what's working, what's maybe not, and what business leaders might want to consider, even though there is this constant drumbeat of, you got to get it. You got to get it today. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah, I think that if you look at the state of AI, then it is a disruptive technology that is still very, very immature. And I think that there is nothing unusual about the way that people are reacting to AI. If you go back to things like smartphones, when they were introduced, you know, that was suddenly going to change everything. And it has
mm-hmm.
over a period of time. AI, of course, is very much more complex than that, because it does have, particularly when you get into things like generative AI, you're starting to get moved away completely from just pure machine learning to the way in which you are interfacing with technology and the way that that technology is then learning as it develops. And so that shines a light on the importance of the integrity of the data that you're providing it with. You know, are there biases in some of the data sets that it's using? How are you, as the human interface, managing the outputs? Look at that from a business standpoint. You know, if you are thinking about moving into a new business area and you're using predictive analytics from an AI, how do you really know that the decision you're making based on those analytics is the right one for the business? You have to be very certain that the information it has used to produce the recommendations hasn't been tampered with, has a high degree of integrity, doesn't have bias. And I think that one of the concerns that I have is that I don't believe that we're at that stage of maturity, we as people, in terms of the way that we're using AI. So that there has to be, and this is what I found so refreshing almost about what Ellie was saying, this sort of slowing down. You know, this, yes, recognizing that there is a significant amount of potential benefit, but in order to get that potential benefit, we need to take a step back almost and just make sure that what we are putting into the AI is sufficiently valuable, valid, has the right degree of integrity, call it what you will, to give you the output that you're expecting. And then we have to wrap all of that in a big security wrapper, I believe, before we even think about using it. Because the ability to tinker with some of that data, to give false readings, the ability for bad actors to actually pick up AI and start using that as well. If you look at some of the publicly available AI that's out there, the kinds of things that people are sharing with that, again, you know, we talk about the internet being the Wild West. Well, AI is up there with it. And this is why a lot of organizations, I think, are somewhat concerned about providing access to things like ChatGPT within their organization, because they're concerned that employees may share information that they would rather they didn't. And so we're lagging, if you like, from a business standpoint, behind where the technology is. And so there needs to be an upskilling in terms of how we use it, a pause to actually think about the implications of it. But there's absolutely no doubt that it has the potential to absolutely transform the way in which businesses run and indeed, you know, the way in which the whole social environment operates as well. So there's a lot of good stuff that we can get from it. We just need to make sure that we don't stuff it up.
Well, what you just said, that we need upskilling. But what Ellie, the point she made that I thought was so kind of chilling, was that we're in a cyber skills shortage with existing tools. We've been in a cyber skills shortage, and now we're introducing AI. And her prediction was that we were years away, 5 to 8 years away from having the adequate skills to manage that. And it, she also said this is a technology that even those who work on it and understand it best don't fully understand. So, you know, I've gotten kind of freaked out on podcasts with you before, but this is a new point of, you know, are we going to be able to manage it? Has the horse left the barn already? Is it too late? Is there any pulling back? Is there any possibility of slowing down, or what do we do?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of discussion, aren't we, around, you know, how might we regulate it? How might we legislate? Now, you're always going to find regulators, legislators being late to the party, because that's the very nature of it, right? That's they're never going to be ahead of the game. So we should never expect that. I think that what we have is a very powerful technology. And I think that, you know, it's interesting, and I touched on this with her, about the difference in camps between those that think we should be slowing down, those that think that if we slow down, well, then we're going to lose an opportunity because, you know, the other countries will not slow down, and all of that sort of stuff, which takes us into the realms of politics rather than technology and the implications that are associated with AI. But that in itself is interesting, isn't it? Because now we're seeing technology as having, you know, geopolitical implications. Something, again, that we've talked about for quite some while. So I think that with any form of technology, you always need to know how to switch it off. You always need to know how to recover from it. As you know, I'm a huge skeptic when it comes to technology. I'm not one of these people that believes necessarily that it will work perfectly 100% of the time.
Right. And, well, we know it won't.
And lots of people say to me, you know, Steve, it'll work 99.7% of the time, and that's good enough. Well, it's not good enough if you happen to be in the 0.3% where it's not worked.
Right.
But again, it comes down to risk and the balancing of risk. But I don't think we're anywhere near that point when it comes to AI. I simply don't think we know enough about some of the implications of what is going on there. And the fact that we do have a lot of, it's out in the wild, OpenAI, so it is learning very, very quickly, means that we also need to be learning what it's learning.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that, you know, we need to be watching what it is doing, how it is doing it, and to be, again, just making sure that there are checks and balances along the way. And then if you go back into the whole, you know, standard security space, from a security standpoint, we do need to make sure that within a business, our crown jewels are not being put at risk, so they're not being shared. We need to make sure outside of a business environment that we're educating people sufficiently to be able to identify things like phishing scams, which have become increasingly more sophisticated with AI. Deepfakes, we talked about that, you know, years ago, again at the ISF. AI is particularly good at that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have commercialized that whole sort of deepfake technology, you know, so that you can, again, benefit from talking to your particular hero or fans. So there's this fine balance, I think, is where I'm coming to with AI. And it's more powerful than anything we've had before. And we've struggled in the past to get security and all of those things, you know, put together around it. And so this is going to present us with yet another challenge at a time, as we say, when resources are somewhat scarce. So what does that mean from a business standpoint? Well, it means that we have to have sensible conversations within our businesses about the role that AI has to play. We need to be making sure that we understand how it's being used, that we're monitoring and measuring that. We need to make sure that any data we're providing it with is the right data. So that whole issue of confidentiality and integrity from the security standpoint starts to come to the fore. And we need to be educating our boards as well as to the implications of things going wrong. So we've done quite a lot, I think, in terms of educating the board about the importance of security, running cyber exercises to reflect what happens when things go wrong, business continuity planning, the role of individual directors, and so on. But AI takes it to an entirely different level.
Yeah.
And all of those things need to be coming into the mix. And so I would really like to see us revisiting not just our policies, but also things like our education, our awareness programs within companies to really take into account the fact for those that have adopted AI systems that they are there and it does bring a slightly different complexion to the way in which people have to just be a little bit more mindful of what they're doing and careful.
Are you optimistic?
About what?
About reconnecting with those human virtues of integrity, wisdom, collaboration. Are we going to, with the sort of noise of ever-increasing technology, does it give us an opportunity to look at what is not technological but is the human soul as the lead in, if we want to manage these things, we have to go back to human virtue and thoughtfulness, mindfulness, deep conversation, transparency?
I think we're starting to see some of that in very small pockets. I think that, as with most things, you probably need to push it a lot further down the road before you get to that point. I mean, if you look specifically at AI, I think that there are tremendous benefits that it can bring to mankind, particularly in the areas of things like medical research,
mm-hmm.
security being one, and a whole range of other areas where we know it's being used at the moment in business. But the bit for me that I'm not quite so sure about, and I'm sure this will resonate with you, is when we then take it into the realms of art. So creating art, for instance. You know, we did this for our latest Threat Horizon report. You know, we had AI generate the front cover for us based on what we told it was actually in the report, which was interesting. And actually, I quite like that picture. But then you get to a point where AI can replicate, you know, the works of the Grand Masters. It only needs to listen to a small snippet of your voice. And before you know it, you're no longer creating audiobooks because an AI can do it quicker, cheaper, and it has the majority of the same inflection that you would bring to it. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? I don't know. I mean, I think you're always going to get two different camps on that one. And so I think that those are the sorts of areas for me where I'm not so sure. I'm pretty comfortable that if we get it right, it can transform things like medical research and some mm-hmm. of the other areas. And so I'm in favor of it there. I'm a little bit more reluctant when it comes to art, the more creative side of things, and what that then means from a sort of, you know, mankind point of view. But I guess we'll find out.
I guess we will. Well, you mentioned Threat Horizon. We're going to take a break in our distribution of podcasts. We'll be away for a week, and then we'll come back with a Threat Horizon series. So we will continue to have these lighthearted conversations for our annual look ahead at what's on the horizon. But thank you so much for your time. And these were three really interesting conversations. I hope that they're of great benefit to our listeners, and we will be back with more.
If you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.